Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis, but I'm without my co-host, Ben Pronk. And there's a good reason for that. This particular special episode was recorded for the Returned and Services League, or the RSL. Now, for those that haven't heard of the RSL started in 1916 as a support organisation for men and women who served or are serving. And Maxine Brown, a communications officer with the RSL, wanted to interview Ben and I on the topic of mateship. But then things took an unexpected turn. We talk not just mateship, but risk-taking, including in our business, challenges, the importance of family, and artifacts like silly hats and fringe magnets, as well as social identity. There's a bit in here for those that continue to serve, have served, but also those who have never served. And the tell for me was at the end of the interview, Ben gave me a big hug. But he also said, we cannot talk about this with anyone. This audio should never be played to anyone. And that's why I'm releasing this as a special. Truly insubordinate, as always. Let's get on with the show.
As I said earlier, I'd like to explore the subject of mateship. And so maybe we can start off with what mateship means to you both individually.
So we're reflecting on this, and there's a fantastic piece of work written by Henry Lawson in 1907. And he talks about a sketch of mateship. It's a story of a couple of shearers, one who wants to sell his horse but doesn't have the skills to do the sales work, and his friend, who's a raconteur, a conversationalist, but also a bit of a villain. And he goes and sells the horse on behalf of his friend. And when they meet back up, he said, yeah, I got £8 for your horse. His friend said, well, you know, let's have the money. And he looks, you know, disheveled and says, I don't have the money. I spent it all and gambled it last night, but can I borrow a pound? And the friend whose horse it was said, sure, gave him a pound, and then they went to the pub. So instead of him persecuting his friend for losing the money from the sale of the horse, they went in and enjoyed a beer together. And for us, the title's really powerful, A Sketch of Mateship. We interpret from that that there is no one definition of mateship. You can't reduce it down to a couple of sound bites. And as Henry Lawson found, you can't easily write about what constitutes mateship. I think for me, there's probably, if we were to reduce it down, there's probably a few things. The basis of mateship, in my opinion, is a shared and common experience. And I think that experience has to be hardship. Anything that you do that's difficult with other people produces a platform for mateship. The next piece, of course, is some level of equality. And the last one is a strong commitment to providing assistance regardless of the circumstance. And if I were to put those three things in a triangle, they would be a very simple explanation of mateship. And I think that it doesn't matter whether you're a netball team and you've just lost a grand final, or a football team and you've won a grand final but pre-season was really hard, or you've been through recruit training or SAS selection or been on operations, those three things remain pretty consistent.
Look, I'd agree. I reckon that idea of unconditionality is really important, and that's the basis of any good human relationship, that it is not purely transactional. You know, it's not a quid pro quo. There is just that sense you can rely on that person. And I think, you know, if you unpack the sort of Anzac myth, you know, which is fundamental to the military concept of mateship, it is that you won't let your mate down, that, you know, regardless of the circumstances, you've got their back. And I think that's at the basis of this particularly Australian notion.
It spans genders, it spans classes, it spans cultures. So we often, I think historically, have talked about mates in a male context, but we don't see that in contemporary society. You know, it is very transferable, I think, regardless of industry, regardless of sector, regardless of gender, regardless of culture, regardless of sporting endeavour or professional endeavour.
Yeah. It's a very Australian concept, but I've been blown away at the intensity of it in a military context, having taken over the Facebook page for RSLWA and actually seeing firsthand how veterans will just throw down anything to step up for someone in need has just been such a beautiful thing to see firsthand.
Tim's point about some level of common hardship, there's an identification based on the fact that you've done a similar thing that was difficult in the past. I think that manifests well in a military context because, you know, it's very identifiable. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of corporate clients that we're working with now. Those preconditions exist, but often they're not recognised. People aren't, celebrating or identifying that they've shared a hardship together. And I think that kind of, that's a missed opportunity. You know, we can look at those things as a foundation for mateship. Tim talks a lot about these ideas of happiness and success being absolutely contingent on having overcome some difficulty. And so to reframe the way we look at our relationships with people, you know, celebrating those little wins, those times when we have overcome difficulty, I reckon that can be a really important thing for any group of people, and it's fundamental to this idea of mateship.
I agree. So when did you both first meet? Was it before service or in service?
In service.
In service.
Tim was my boss.
Yep.
The idea of mateship was not strong.
it was a classic servant-master relationship.
I thought you were going to say student-mentor. You know, you learn a lot from your good bosses. You learn even more from your bad bosses. Yep. I learned a lot from Tim. No. So I'd been in the SAS regiment for 1 year as a troop commander, and they tend to stagger the rotations of the different command levels. Our squadron commander was posted out, and Tim posted in as our squadron commander. So that was the first time we met.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you serve together?
It seems like forever, but it was actually just a little over 12 months. So Ben was posted out midway through my tenure. And then we stayed in touch, and in particular when Ben came back and he was the commanding officer of the SAS regiment, we reconnected for more social reasons than anything else. We restarted a conversation, and then Ben left the SAS. He did a full-time MBA. I'd been through an MBA program, and so we stayed in touch. And towards the end of the MBA, when Ben was exploring what he might like to do next, we happened on this mad, crazy idea that we should go into business together. Yeah, and true. Here we are.
So where did the seed of that spring from?
It was the MBA for me was this watershed year. Not only was the content excellent and, you know, good transferable skills, but it was a period for me, I think for the first time in my life, to stop and try and figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. I'd been in the military, loved it till the day I left. But it was the first chance for me to take a breath and think about what next. And having Tim, sort of reconnecting with Tim, getting an understanding of what he'd done in the past, and for me, really, the art of the possible. You know, I guess I'd always, from the military, and I think this is common of a lot of veterans, fantastic institution, but very structured, very secure. It sounds paradoxical when you're saying, you know, a job where you get shot at can be secure, but, you know, it is a secure from a professional point of view. But having reconnected with Tim and, you know, his experience post-military, really gave us the foundation to be able to try and start something new and this what has turned out to be a wonderful both professional and personal venture.
Yeah.
And my path, I guess, as we collided professionally again, came off the back of 10 years in the Middle East, and I ran a group of 42 companies. We were truly global about 14 countries, 1,400 staff, and I got incredibly homesick at the tail end of that time. And when I came home, I realised that not only was I homesick, but I was incredibly burnt out. And fast forward 2 years, when Ben was doing his MBA, my pilot light had turned back on to build another business. And so I didn't want to just be freelance consulting and doing things that were more casual. I really wanted to commit to building the business. So part of the discussion that we had was, well, what is our joint commitment? And if we've got this common purpose, then I think we're going to be successful.
And that was how long ago?
Start of last year. I mean, we incorporated at the start of last year. We'd started the discussions mid-2017. Yeah.
And we took a bit of risk from the outset. So we acquired a company called Crisis Leaders that I'd done work for since 2004 off and on, a specialist crisis and emergency management and business continuity management company. Mm-hmm. So working across the spectrum of risk.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no better test, I think, when you take financial risk in the initial steps of a business because you believe in your ability to deliver against it.
And this, I think, talks to this idea of mateship, a really important sort of moment in this decision for me. We were in a cafe in Cottesloe sort of sketching out what this might look like. And we'd been dancing around each other a little in terms of how would we break down the ownership and the equity and the income and, you know, what if this is your client, what if this is mine, but what if I, you know, we were sort of doing that little very important discussion. And we eventually both realised this isn't going to work unless we just say this is 50-50, we're both putting in, we're not counting the unders and overs, but we're both committing fully to this. And it was at that point, you know, I spoke about that unconditionality. You know, I knew, and I think this is part of that common background and the fact that I knew Tim from the military, but I knew that we were just going to go full steam on this and we didn't need to count or look over each other's shoulders as to what was happening. If we both committed 100% into this job, then it would work out, and it has. And that's been a fantastic, that foundation of trust is absolutely critical to what we're doing now, and it's just made it so easy and enjoyable in terms of a professional pursuit.
The other thing I think's always been important is this Japanese concept of family. And when we made that commitment together, we literally sketched our plan out on a napkin. We knew that indelibly entwined in there were two families, his, Ben's, and my family, and we had given a commitment to our families that, you know, we were going to make this thing work and we were seeking their support in doing it. And so I think burning in the back of my mind is that we just don't want to let our families down.
That was an underhanded little trick. Every time I think about clearing out the bank account, I think of your poor children going without.
Yeah, that's right. Look, and I think the other one that definitely relates into that, having run a business for 10 years with people who I didn't have shared and common understanding
values, yeah,
and challenges with, the conversations with those people were often quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of, well, a need to be politically correct at times, to pad out conversations that perhaps could have been abridged and shortened. And fast forward to my business relationship with Ben, the hard conversations are easy. And I think that's a super tell. Coming back to your point on mateship and certainly our professional backgrounds, without question contribute to this. That's a tell for me in being able to work with someone where you don't have to struggle through the difficult conversations. And I'm also a believer to have the hard conversations early. And we did that over the napkin, in the way that the shareholding would break out. And we probably do that most days over things, but we don't have to labour the discussion.
Which goes back to that point about, you know, the all-in. I think we do have very complementary skills. There's areas that I wish I was a ton more like Tim in, but we're able to sort of round that out in terms of a team, which is
so
a really
a balance
good way to work.
Of strengths and weaknesses.
Without a doubt.
Best teams.
Yeah, I've got the strengths.
I've got the opportunities and threats.
No, it is. It's a really good mix.
This will be a random question, but I don't suppose either of you hung on to that napkin.
Yes, we have, and we have every intention to get it framed and put it up in pride of place in the boardroom.
Seriously, you're not taking the mickey?
I'm dead serious.
Serious?
Yep.
I don't think it's got any trade secrets. I don't think we've got any trade secrets, but...
But that is Exhibit A in our board minutes.
But you know what? I mean, these ideas of these artifacts, like having something tangible, like a silly napkin with some scribble on it, but that represents something really important for us. Like that's... And, you know, we used to do incredible things to wear a silly Sandy hat, you know, in the SAS regiment. I mean, people, these are important, these tokens, these artifacts. And, yeah, even just silly things like the fridge magnet collection. When we consult in a different company, we bring back a fridge magnet. It's a manifestation of what we're building. And I reckon that's pretty important to this concept of
matrix. Yeah. So is it fair to assume that both your families would be pretty tight also?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. We sort of, I mean, we're very antisocial, my wife and I. But yeah, no, there's a good relationship between the families. But yeah, we sort of, it's a busy job at the moment. And for us in particular, time when we are together as a family is pretty sacred.
Because you are both away a lot, right?
Yeah. I mean, Ben talks this beautifully about, you know, that the concept of teamwork, which doesn't actually just start and finish in the office. And if you're truly involved in a vocation, then your family are committed to that, and they didn't volunteer.
Yeah.
They are with us, supportive through thick and thin, including the fact that, you know, we put our hand deep in our pocket right at the start with pretty much no runs on the board with this particular brand to buy a company and take a real risk.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly important part of our being here.
So it was an all-in scenario.
Yeah, it was. And it was also, I mean, I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about it is that we're clear on what our goals are, and they're not just financial. We are, you know, I think there is a trap to just pursue bigger, better, more money, all that sort of stuff. But for us, a big part of this is quality of life and enjoying our existence. And I mean, if you're going to spend 8 hours a day plus in a work environment, you want to be enjoying it. And we've really been gearing towards that.
Ben, you asked a question probably 9-10 months ago that nearly has become a point of calibration for us. And the question was, how can our lives get better? And we often come back to that when we're considering doing something. Does it fit into the end state of our lives being a little bit better than they were yesterday? And if the answer's no, then why would you do it?
Exactly.
And I'm not talking about Ben and I, but all of our colleagues. Yeah, that's a real point of zeroization to be able to work out, well, does it make our life better? Does it improve us as human beings? Does it improve us individually and collectively?
And this is where our previous experience, I think, has been really useful, and we reflect on this a lot. So thing one, we've both been to some pretty lousy parts of the world, and that, I think, provides this perspective that we're living in this gorgeous pocket of Australia, which is this amazingly fortunate country. So, you know, let's sort of keep things in perspective there. Second thing is, through both our military service and since getting out, we've dealt with a lot of very rich people, and enough to recognise that money certainly doesn't correlate perfectly with happiness. And so, you know, careful what you wish for in that sense. So, yeah, I think that provides a good framework to work out, well, what does success look like? What does happiness look like? And, you know, we constantly talk about, you know, things are pretty good. You know, do we want to sort of paint a future where we're looking back and thinking, gee, I wish we hadn't grown bigger or took on more work or whatever, because there's a lot of enjoyment in actually doing a really good quality or delivering a quality product, and we don't want to scale to the point where we dilute that. So yeah, these are all sort of factors into how we want to see the business grow.
Actually, for the purpose of the audio, could we just perhaps get a brief broad brush perspective of what you actually do?
So I'll talk to the first arm of the business, which is crisis and emergency management inside our Crisis Leaders brand. So that delivers consulting services focused on the reduction of risk, either pre-incident or post-incident, across the whole spectrum of risk to last year, 100 clients in 23 countries. So it's been a very dynamic business. The methodology's been built up for over 18 years. And what we do in that is we prepare management teams ahead of things going catastrophically wrong. But if when things do go wrong, we also teach them the techniques, the processes, the practicals that are practical tools that are highly applied that enable them to recover their business or recover their organisation.
Now, our second practice area is focused on leadership and resilience. And this was born for me out of my reflections in my MBA, where I was studying with this whole group of really super sharp young men and women. I was going to say kids, they felt much younger than me, but they were incredible, top of their game. However, they had never, many of them had never had any formal leadership training. And coming from the military, where you have this continuum of leadership training appropriate for the level that you're leading at, that sets you up with the theory that you can then put in practice in your day job, to see these folk who are about to transition from, you know, doing the job they'd been hired to do to actually leading people, many I didn't feel were set up for success. And so that was a real catalyst for us to recognise that there is a requirement, you know, across a whole bunch of industries to get better at this. And so this forms the genesis of our leadership arm. We work in conjunction with the Australian Graduate School of Management in this area. We're both faculty of AGSM and deliver programs on their behalf as well as within our own brand. And the interesting thing, and what's exciting for us at the moment, is that obviously these ideas of crisis management and leadership are not, you know, mutually exclusive, and we're seeing a really good relationship between those both ways. You need excellent leadership in a crisis. You need to be able to make a decision, adapt it, convey intent, communicate clearly, inspire people, give them confidence. But we're also seeing that the training we do in crisis management serves as an excellent leadership laboratory for business as usual situations. So there's a really good relationship between those two, which we're developing.
Fantastic. And when it comes to needing bodies on the ground with the risk management, do you have a team on standby? Do you draw from contract personnel?
Yeah, we have 23 consultants dotted around the world, and in fact most of them are ex-military. There are a few that aren't, but most of them are. And they understand the methodology implicitly, and they deliver that methodology to ensure that we get a consistent look and feel for all of our clients. I mean, we've got 18 years of data, particularly for crisis and emergency management. So we know the things that done well get great results, and we really only teach those things. So we're not into the theory, we're not into the definitions. All of that is largely irrelevant after there's a significant problem in your organisation. All we want to do is focus on fixing the problem as efficiently, as effectively as we possibly can in order to get business, ideally, back to being better than what it was.
So I'm sensing a heavy percentage of your contractors would be people you've worked with previously?
Yeah, certainly the... As Tim said, we acquired a company with a 7-year trading history. A lot of them, a lot of the contractors came from that previous relationship and have stayed on, which is great. And they are certainly people that the previous company owner had worked with in the past. And yeah, as we develop and build our own sort of networks and expand the business, then it's an easy known quantity, you know, to draw from people that we've served with, that you know are reliable, that you know are able to think under pressure, come up with plans in a crisis. That's the kind of gene pool that we're targeting from, and the military does produce a lot of people like that.
And again, it's that daily practice of the mateship theme again, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that idea of a known quantity, someone that you can rely upon.
Exactly.
It's not going to let you
down. That understanding. So I mean, I'd be interested in perhaps giving our veteran community, especially those who are going through or are facing transition in the future, perhaps some guidance from two men who've managed it so successfully. Are you able to draw on any of your elite military training, like when things get tough, where do you dig down to, and how can our veteran community kind of draw on that to give themselves a bit of motivation?
For me, there's two things. One, I think the Defence Force sets you up incredibly well for a whole bunch of different pursuits outside. What is often needed, however, is some kind of contextualisation of those skills. A lot of what I certainly came out with out of the military with were what I guess are soft skills. It's not a piece of paper that says something. It's not a formal qualification, but it's the ability to tackle a problem, deal with ambiguity, lead people, speak convincingly. These kind of skills, which are very sought after, but in most contexts need a bit of contextualization. They need an ability to transfer it from the military environment into a corporate environment. And so for me, the MBA was a fantastic way of doing that, getting the lexicon and all that sort of stuff. Without a doubt, having Tim, going into business with Tim, he had a vast amount of experience in the corporate environment, provided a massive safety net for me, as well as having that known quantity of the military background. So I think that contextualization, building that bridge between the military and the civilian context, is important. But in terms of what you draw back on, without a doubt, and Tim, you say this often, you know, when you're faced with a problem, you don't go to your MBA textbook, you draw on your military sort of problem solving, appreciation techniques, these kind of things to tackle a problem. And so, yeah, I definitely draw on the military training, the military experience when I'm dealing with a novel situation.
Yeah, for those people transitioning, I completely agree with Ben. They should have confidence that they have something significant to give the world outside a camouflage uniform. That'd be my first point. My second point would be they should not be afraid to take a risk and know that what's backing that risk-based decision is an incredible history, an incredible background, an amazing array of skills, and certainly a community that will continue to support them. Both of those things are important. And then as they look forward into the what's next, I'd ask them to ask the question of themselves, why? You know, why would I go and do something like that profession? And the second thing is ensure that they continue to have a sense of purpose, which is what the military always gave you. It was very, very clear in the direction that you were heading on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. There was always clear direction in terms of orders and briefing. And as we know, the military were fantastic at giving you that mission statement, what they wanted you to achieve. And so continue to use that. If you apply that mission statement outside of the uniform, you know, okay, what am I going to achieve from this? What is the sense of purpose that I'm seeking in taking this role? And being a little critical about that, but confident that you have the knowledge, skills, attributes, and the experience to make a real contribution.
I can imagine it must be a challenge, you know, when you've been in service for so long with such regimented lifestyles and thinking, to kind of reshape your entire experience and personal brand, I guess, per se, and sell it in a different, more civilian format.
I guess we were lucky in that the SAS regiment is probably less sort of regimented. It does demand a bit more fluidity of thinking and dealing with sort of novel environments. But certainly for me, the identity thing was a big one. I mean, I don't think I'd ever acutely thought of this, but when I reflect, you know, a big part of my identity was being a soldier, was being in uniform. And so that transition out of that environment where, you know, you had some status, you were a position, you were part of this big institution, to just being another individual on the street, that was an interesting, from a personal perspective, an interesting transition. Bottom line is, though, you're kind of always a soldier. you've always got that sort of unconditional mateship that, you know, you catch up with your military friends, people you've served overseas with, and it's instantly back to that rapport. There's a lifelong sort of relationship that doesn't go just when you hang up the cams.
The other thing is, outside of The Wire, it is very exciting. It's different, but it's exciting. And you'll find people that are utterly inspiring that you would never have come across in a life in uniform until retirement. That I find really energizing. And there's a bit of a proof when you look through The Wire at all of the fantastic things that people who have been in uniform are doing now. The last two Governor Generals, we've got a West Australian of the Year that's an ex-SAS officer. And people should never be concerned about outreach to ask for advice. And Ben and I get a lot of it from people who are looking to transition and just want a sounding board on the style or sort of thing that they could do. That community is always here for you, which is probably the reason why we're making a contribution back into the RSL.
So you're both on the fundraising committee of the RSL. What was that, a joint decision?
Yeah, it was a bit of a two-for-one offer. We were approached when there were some vacancies, and we both sort of fit the bill in terms of what we were doing, our backgrounds and that sort of thing. So I think our intent had been, you know, we could tag team, but we've ended up being both involved, which is great.
And what is your personal mission there? I mean, ultimately your goals?
Well, I mean, one of the discussion points you've got is the Veterans Central. Coming out of my last job as a commanding officer, the landscape for veterans who need help has been very clouded, very confused. There's so many, and this is a fantastic thing. This wasn't the case in the 70s post-Vietnam. You know, there's so many organisations that can help people. But interestingly, that's created a bit of confusion as to, you know, where do I go, what do I do? So this concept of a one-stop shop where we've got an umbrella that, you know, a veteran who needs assistance, their families who need assistance, can just go somewhere and have an organisation that provides the guidance into the best forms of assistance, that's pretty exciting for me.
And under the one roof. Mm. And under the one roof with other people who have that shared and common experience, understand the hardship that you've been through. That's really a fantastic initiative from RSL.
And I think as well, not only under the one roof, but under a really central roof in a great location, fantastic new building, and things like the social aspects of that, I think that's a really important part. And we see a lot of people, you know, anecdotally, we see our mates who deal well with everything they've been through while they're still in that framework of mateship that's in the military. But when they get out, they can kind of fall off a cliff if they haven't got that that same framework to transition straight to. And I think just the ideas of having a social hub where people can meet, have a meal, catch up, you know, that can help, as I said before, keep that sort of soldier for life, you know, service person for life concept going.
Yeah, it's okay to make a mistake and it's okay to stumble. And I think the beautiful thing about Veterans Central is that it's going to be there to catch you before you fall.
Exactly.
So you can stumble, but there is a safety net there with people who absolutely appreciate what you've done in uniform and understand your particular and very unique circumstances.
For me, a big part of it is just this normalisation of experience. And, you know, we'd feel it, I always felt it was particularly profound after, you know, an operational engagement or a, you know, traumatic or intense experience on operations. Just that ability to sit down with the people who are involved. So we're not talking, you know, there's a place for professional, you know, psychs and all that sort of stuff. But this first line sort of normalization of sitting down with your mates after it and saying, whoa, that was intense, or, you know, just understanding that other people are dealing with the same reactions and their same emotions. A fantastic story, a guy I worked with in the UK on exchange, he was a tornado pilot, fighter pilot, and he spoke about the sort of most upsetting operational experience he had was during the Yugoslavian campaign, where he would... And he described this one mission where he tucked his daughter into bed at night, drove to work, took off on this mission, surface-to-air missiles are coming at him. He's dodging them. He thinks he's going to die. He drops a bomb, which kills a lot of people, you know, flies back through the SAM field again, gets home, this amazingly intense, life-changing experience, very traumatic, and then drives home as his daughter's waking up and it's, you know, cornflakes for breakfast. Just the weird juxtaposition.
And birthday parties. Yeah.
And how you balance that. Yep. And as to Tim's point, police, fire, ambulance, these folk are doing this daily.
Yeah. Mm. What do you think the benefits will be through Veterans Central for not just veterans but their families, considering they are often the unacknowledged...
Yeah, heroes of the situation. Yeah. Look, that clarity, that ability to go somewhere and cut through the maze of you know... support services, and I think hopefully it'll evolve into a place that's a focal point that, you know, is not just there or not just purely associated with a rehabilitative sort of process, but is actually part of a community, part of a social network that allows that sort of support.
Mm. Yeah. And the integrated services. I mean, there are many charities, not-for-profits that provide some level of support to veterans and their families. But because there are many, it's often incredibly confusing about what each one does and who perhaps you could go to. Mm. And the beauty of Veterans Central is it's going to bring all of them together, which will improve collaboration. It'll be more collegiate between those organisations. And because it physically sits in RSL, there's a convenience to it. But there's also a certain level of endorsement from the RSL that these organisations are reputable and providing a tremendous service for you. I think that's important because for their first careers in the military, a lot of that was the reality. You knew that if you went to a dentist or a doctor or a physio or drew a weapon from the armoury, that what sits behind that is a certain level of trust and professionalism, that it's all being put together in the right way.
So is that a bit of a maze that you've had to help mates navigate in the past?
We've certainly seen it. And there's some fantastic people doing great stuff to make that a bit clearer. But I have certainly seen anecdotally mates who just are a bit lost. They don't necessarily know where to turn to. And as Tim mentioned, there's not that coherence in the case management. So they may be getting good... I don't know, physical attention from a physio or whatever for any physical injuries, but maybe it's not linked up with the mental health sides of things. Maybe it's not linked up with the ability to start looking for meaningful work. And so, you know, bringing that together a little bit more, I think, is a really positive step.
We also came from this high trust environment wearing a uniform. And when you cross out into the corporate world and change professions, that's not always the case. Isn't necessarily a high trust environment. So when you're looking for a level of support, not being able to trust who you should go to, that's a real challenge for people that need immediate assistance.
Mm. And again, probably where you again fall back on your military mates, right? Yeah. So for somebody up against those challenges today and maybe the questioning or having doubts in their self-confidence, what would you suggest for them right now?
I think, you know, there is, as I mentioned before, we're in a good place now in that there's a lot of recognition about things like post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the mental and physical health issues that are facing contemporary veterans. However, there's, to me, an element of concern that it's sort of swinging a little further and saying that everyone who's served is going to have damage and are going to be having difficulties. I think most veterans should take a lot of solace in the fact that they've overcome that shared hardship. They've done something difficult through the training, no matter what service you've done, and then, you know, whatever you've done while you're in uniform. And I think as a very first step, you know, I'd encourage veterans to look at what they've achieved, what they've overcome to this point, and use that as a platform to face whatever challenges they're going into. That being said, there are times when people do need assistance and do need help. And as we've said before, this ability to have that one-stop shop to actually reach out to people who understand, who understand what a veteran's been through, the kind of challenges they may be facing, and have the wherewithal to provide that assistance across a range of services, I reckon that's a really exciting prospect.
Exactly. Like self-isolation is kind of a normal human instinct when you're really under it. So sort of reconnect with your mates and in an environment like that would be absolute gold, I imagine.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you see for your future as a partnership?
As I said before, we're constantly looking at the what's next. We're constantly, reminding ourselves of careful what we wish for. But we do see good prospects for growth. We see, and for me, I'm really continuously reassured by the fact that I think we are providing a good service that actually helps a lot of companies, both in the leadership and the crisis management side. And we want to keep doing that. We're very conscious that as we grow, we don't want to dilute the capability, you know, so we want to keep that quality high. We want to keep leveraging the best of, what we can provide. And so it will be a sort of measured escalation as we grow to keep that quality up, and then look at expanding to try and help more companies.
And this will sound peculiar, but I think whatever we do, there has to be a challenge and there has to be a struggle. There has to be some element of risk, because only in doing that will we get some level of professional fulfillment. We always want to adapt. In the unit, we used to talk about this relentless pursuit of excellence. We've tried to cross that over. I don't think we deliver a piece of work, regardless of what that piece of work is now, without looking critically at the way that we could have improved and then modifying and adapting for the next time. Mm-hmm. All of those, for me, I find very exciting. I really get inspired by that. But we know looking forward that we want obstacles to be able to overcome. You know, that's the style of people that we are, and that's the style of people that we employ, people who can problem solve, think on their feet, and inspire others to do the same.
Exactly. Actually, that gives me an opening for a question I wanted to ask earlier. Was there a moment in your time serving together? I think most friendships have a defining moment, and obviously your friendship blossomed under duress in times of hardship. Was there one particular conflict or sortie or adventure that really kind of cemented your bond?
I do reckon we've spoken before about the Pong Su mission. Tim was the squadron commander for that. I was the deployed troop commander, and it was a really you talk about that shared hardship. It was a pretty unpleasant couple of days doing the planning under a lot of pressure. There was a lot of strategic and political interest in what was happening. We were in a ship that was rocking around in Sea State 6, constantly seasick. I don't think we slept for about 36, 40-odd hours. And I thought a real potential that things could go terribly wrong and that we could lose some of our mates, some of our soldiers, people who trusted us to come up with a plan to achieve the mission and bring them home safe. And so working together on that and in very complementary roles, I mean, I don't remember a lot of what was going on in the sort of political strategic background, because Tim was fielding a lot of that pressure, a lot of the alignment of the different assets, and I was focused sort of down on the tactical plan. But again, that unconditional knowledge that this guy was going to keep working round the clock, you know, sort of throwing up into a waste paper bin next to him while he's doing the planning.
I have never been seasick, Ben.
I was throwing up in a waste paper bin while I was doing the planning. Yeah, I didn't realise that. Oh, you've just gone down, in my opinion. Yeah. either way, yeah, that was a real crucible moment. But also, I mean, more recently, setting this thing up, the first 6 months, Tim spoke about wanting that new challenge. Again, careful what you wish for. This was definitely a new challenge for me. I constantly felt for 6 months like I just had my nose above water as I was lurching from engagement to engagement. But it was that period after the thing I said before, we decided we're all in, split it down the middle and just work at this. And we were both going hard. And this was a really good example of that complementary skills where, you know, I'd be doing some of the back office work. Tim, in those early stages, I think was really carrying the lion's share of things like delivery and business development. But, you know, we both knew, you know, we'd be up there at 10 o'clock at night in our respective homes sort of texting each other. You know, we were both sort of full on at it. And I feel super proud and super thankful to have had Tim there, to have got through that, to have, you know, got over that hump of a new business, establishing it and getting a foothold. And I think now we're really starting to see an inflection point in terms of that work paying off.
Yeah, you asked the question about the defining moment and back to the Pongsu where there was an incredible amount of complexity. Actually, we've spoken extensively on the operation in a range of different forums, but nothing really was programmed to be in our favour. We didn't have our preferred complement of SAS guys mm-hmm. and girls. We didn't have our own small craft. We didn't have our own helicopters. The sea state Ben mentioned was extraordinary, and the last thing was the intelligence picture was poor. And I guess that defining moment that you asked about became clear to me when you can go to Ben, who was leading on the tactical planning, and just ask him the question, where do you want me to be? What do you need me to do? He's planned that for you. He tells you precisely what the expectation is, and that's it. You know, that to me reflects a certain confidence that people who are working on your behalf inside that shared and common hardship, but understand the wider intent. That's a really powerful vehicle.
Okay, last question. Can I ask you each to describe each other in one sentence?
Ben talks about a lattice work of models. He stole it from Charlie Munger. He's a good aggregator like that. Some would call plagiarist, but Ben, but Ben applies that lattice work of models. You know, he's a generalist in very many things. There's tremendous variety in what he does. Most won't be aware that he's a very accomplished artist, but you know, he speaks well, he writes well, he loves his family, loves his kids. And all of those things, I think, blend beautifully into a lattice work for life, for happiness, for fun, and for success.
Was that one sentence?
Nearly.
I was going to go a lot more succinct. And, you know, we're talking about mateship. I mean, Tim is a mate. If you talk about, or if you look at all the sort of ways we've chosen to define mateship, and in particular that unconditionality that sort of got your back, you know that you can rely on this person, then that's Tim. Expanding on that as well, particularly in this context, there's a lot of things that Tim does, I think, naturally as part of who he is that I guess aspire to. I constantly want to learn. He used that phrase about having the difficult conversations early. Tim is able to do that, and it just sets such a beautiful clarity for not only our business relationship, but also our interactions with other people, both staff, clients, friends, being what you see is what you get, no garbage, no sort of facades or any of that sort of thing, but knowing that you're talking with the genuine person and that what he says is what he means. It's a really good foundation.
Was that one sentence?
No. there are a lot of semicolons. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you couldn't get higher praise. That's a beautiful thing to hear.
Watch this space in 6 months' time when I run off with them.
Wow. Well, thank you, guys. It's been an incredible interview and gorgeous insight into both of you. I wasn't expecting nearly as philosophical or a genuine discussion, so it's been a pleasure and an honour.
Thanks, Maxine.
Thank you.
them's flowing, not far enough. One of them's crying for what has made it sad. One of them's dying from what it never, ever, ever had. Wasting away, birds of a feather, counting the days, wishing for leaving, what it's like to be free, dreaming of sunshine. Wishing for leaving, what it's like to be free, dreaming of sunshine.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.